From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
When you're talking plants and not people, how do you figure out who lives where? You can't send census takers door to door to get a head count, but doing so is a critical step in devising conservation strategies in a changing world, among other key goals. More from a New York Botanical Garden botanist who's coordinating such an effort, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Robert Nozzi is a curator of North American botany at the New York Botanical Garden, where a classic reference to the plants of all or part of 22 United States states and 5 Canadian provinces is being fully updated. I'm so glad to welcome him to the show today. How are you?
I'm fine, Margaret. Thank you.
Thank you for making time, Rob. This is great. And the title of the manual, the New Manual of Vascular Plants of Northeastern United States and Adjacent Canada, oh boy.
it's
a mouthful, but many users know the reference as Gleason and Cronquist for its previous editors. But tell us a little about the history of the book and why it's so important.
Sure. Thank you. This book is in a lineage that began at New York Botanical Garden with our founding director, Nathaniel Lord Britton. So he had a project when he began the garden, and he published the first volume of that, The Illustrated Flora, in 1896. And when the garden was founded, he finished with The Illustrated Flora, and then he got the idea, let's make a condensed version, a one-volume book handy for field use, and he called that The Manual of the Flora of the Northern States and Canada.
Oh.
So he published that in 1901, and in short order, that book went through several editions. And then the next thing really big to happen was Henry Allen Gleason was a great botanist here, and he got the idea to renew the manual series, and he teamed up with the younger botanist also at the garden, Arthur Cronquist. And in 1963, they published their updated manual. And then Gleason and Cronquist published their second edition in 1991. And that book has been in press for a while.
Right.
And as we've made many discoveries in botany since 1991, the garden realized we needed to update that. They actually opened the position of curator of North American botany.
And here you are.
The chief duty, and there I am,
yeah.
With the chief duty of writing this new manual.
Yeah. So I want to talk about some of the new things that you're finding out. But first, how do you even do such a project? I mean, I'm assuming that you don't literally on your own alone go out and try to count all the plants. And I know there's other projects like the New York Flora Atlas, for instance, just to name the one in my state, or VASCAN, which I think is the vascular plants of Canada and so forth. Do you kind of take in data from elsewhere? Is it a collaboration? How does it work a little bit?
It's very much a collaboration. We benefit from those resources, and we in turn help them.
Uh-huh.
So it's an ambitious project. We estimate that we have 5,300 species that grow spontaneously or grow in the wild within the region, the geographic region covered by the new manual. And so this is a multi-year project, and we depend upon resources like the New York Flora Atlas and VASCAN, the Vascular Plant Database for Canada, and many other similar projects. And then as we write our treatments for every family, those projects benefit from the updated resources we provide on identification, et cetera.
Oh, so it's kind of a two-way street. That's great. So it's iterative, collaborative. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I know you're not done by any means, but how significant so far, and you've done some plant families, you've issued these sort of reports on some of the plant families and you're working your way through. How significant are the changes from that previous edition, which when you began was like about 25 years old, that 1991 edition? And what are the factors that are causing the changes, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. It's one near and dear to my heart. The changes are pretty significant. So I did an analysis of the families that we published our first year, and that was 28 of them. And then I up updated that in my second year. And by this point, we have 91 families published through New York Botanical Garden Press. And what we found is that on average, there's a 21% increase in the number of species recognized
wow.
in annual treatments relative to Gleason and Cronquist. And you asked about the causes, and that's a natural question. So we find that the reasons for these increases boil down to three. One of them is our increase in understanding of the plants themselves, how to classify them. So, for example, in the past, sometimes we considered one species that we now recognize to be two or three.
Oh.
And then another, which actually is the leading cause for the increase, is the introduction of non-natives. Non-native species that have been brought in intentionally or unintentionally, but most often intentionally mm-hmm. for gardening purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And they have gotten loose, so to speak. They've become established in our flora. And then the third reason is that even though our region is relatively well known botanically, we still continue to make discoveries in our native flora within this region. So that also adds to that total of, as I say, an average of 21% increase in number of species.
So things, there's an increase in our understanding, and especially of how to classify, and then there is this infusion, invasion of different plants that just weren't there 25 years ago or hadn't taken hold in, become wild, or they were maybe still in gardens. If they did exist at all, they were still in gardens. They weren't.
Some were, and then actually some have been introduced very recently since 1991 and taken off
really quickly. Really quickly, yeah.
And you're right. Some of them have become invasive. Not all.
Yeah.
But some of them have become invasive. So one of the criteria for inclusion of a species in the new manual is that it must be established in the flora. In other words,
right, that's the word you used, established.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's say one of these species got loose from a garden and was growing 100 feet away from someone's property, and that's the only place we know of it, and there are only two plants growing there. That's not really reason for including it because it's not completely established. It's not something that an average botanist is likely to run across.
Okay, I see. So you mentioned, of course, a lot of your answer was about invasive plants, but you also mentioned things we didn't used to know so well. And one of those things, you know, we gardeners love to blame you botanists for everything. No.
Right.
Actually, you can blame us. You can blame us for things like some of the lust after some of the plants that proved invasive, but we can in turn blame you for reclassifying plants and confusing the heck out of us.
Right.
And so that's that sort of molecular systematics or whatever, where taxonomists, because they're able to observe plants at that tiny little level, at the gene level, they can figure out who's really related to who, and so they rename them. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. So don't worry. I have a thick skin when it comes to blame for all sorts of things, especially name changes.
Yeah.
And very briefly on that, we botanists see it from a different perspective. And I like to use a quote from one of the great botanists of this past century, Lincoln Constance from University of California. He called our field of plant systematics an unending synthesis.
Oh.
So we continue to bring in data. We continue to learn. We continue to discover. And what are we aiming for? We bring all of this knowledge to bear on improving our classification system. And by doing that, it's necessary to refine what mm-hmm. came before. So we see it as a way, we botanists see it as a way to improve upon what we've been doing all along. But unfortunately, it does mean for the average person, the general public, that there are some changes. Now, a lot of name changes recently because with molecular systematics,
yeah.
we've been making so many discoveries. So let's take an example of some of these discoveries. If you were to look in the 1991 edition of Gleason and Cronquist, you would see two families, the dogbane family, Apocynaceae,
yes.
and the milkweed family, the Asclepiadaceae. But in the new manual, we've actually combined those two families, and the name is Apocynaceae when we combine them. So it's one of the names that was out there.
Right.
But in this case, we're actually lumping things. We have fewer families. We have one family instead of two. And why do we do that? Because we discovered in our efforts to reflect the long-term change, the phylogeny, the long-term or evolutionary history of plants, in our effort to do that and make a natural classification, that it's actually more reflective of what happened if we do have the one family, because it is the all of the descendants of a common ancestor based upon our present evidence and analyses, and that's what we're aiming to do with our modern methods. So that's one example of a change. And then we have other examples where the snapdragon family, as recognized in 1991, is now 8 or 9 families. So it can go both directions.
Yes, it can. And I think it's harder for me when you make more new ones that I never heard the name of before than when you lump. Then I'm more apt to get it.
That's why I thought I'd start with the lumping.
Right. Tell me the good news first, Rob. Right.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the dogbane family. And because when I was reading some of the reports that you have published so far, some of the family reports that you've published so far in this effort, and you said you've done 91 so far. How many are there going to be total, by the way?
About 230.
Okay. So, you know, I was reading some of them, and I don't have the training, the expertise, the education in this. So I'm an advanced beginner or a beginning intermediate kind of person, and so I recognize some of it. But what I did get as I read through from family to family was that that family, the dogbane family, was a good example of also the sort of invasive story. Like the species sort of counted, they counted in more than one family report published so far, sort of tell the story of this increasing pressure and presence of invasive plants. But that one, the dogbane family, it was like there were some like vinca was in it, and now the dreaded swallowwort, which is a newer, or I don't know how much newer, but it's a different type of a situation. It's not like our garden ground cover. So it was an interesting group, and there are also popular plants that we covet and we haven't been told are not a good thing. In fact, some natives like Amsonia is in there too.
The blue stars, sure.
So how is isn't it interesting that in one family they are and milkweed is something, of course, all the gardeners want because it's
the butterflies.
Exactly. And it's such an interesting family. Now, does Amsonia have that complicated sort of chemistry like the dogbane and the milkweeds?
I have to be honest and say I don't know much about.
Yeah, I don't know either. It doesn't. It never struck me that
way. I've not heard about any of our butterflies feeding on them, but I imagine there are insects.
Yeah.
Because most of our plants do support a whole suite of insects.
Yeah.
Some that are generalists and some very specific.
Yeah.
But Amsonia illustrates, and some of these others, like vinca especially, illustrate how plants. We bring them in, they become popular for a while. Many of them, fortunately, remain popular, but then others, like vinca, they fall out of favor as we discover they have these aggressive tendencies. And many of our plants that are non-native, we grow them for a while, and they seem well-behaved, and they're going through what we call, what we scientists call a lag phase. They're building up their numbers, their seeds in the environment, and then all of a sudden it seems like they explode in multiple places and invasive. So we have some tools of predicting which species will become invasive.
Oh.
And we have discovered, we who study invasive plants have discovered that the leading cause, and I'm sorry I have to break the news to you, the leading cause of introduction of invasives is actually horticulture, gardening, because most of these invasives are attractive to us. And that is a good thing. They're beautiful plants, but we should admit it. That's also the problem. We want them because they're beautiful, they're easy to grow, they're aggressive, they seed easily, but some of those same characteristics are what make them invasive.
Right, as we used to say, we used to call them doers. You know what I mean? A plant,
yes.
I would call them confidence builders, you know, plants that,
right.
Oops.
For those of us that do not have the greenest of thumbs.
Right, and sure enough, that can turn on you and it can turn out it's a thug, and it can be even worse than that and be something that then invades natural areas beyond
but
your
but
garden.
But you're right, Margaret, that this family, the Apocynaceae, the dogbane family, well as illustrates what a mix we can have, because within the family, especially in the genus Asclepias, the milkweeds, We have a tremendous number of rare species. In nature, many of these plants have very low numbers in each population, yet they've supported themselves through the eons. This is just a different strategy for them for their living in their populations. It's not like the common milkweed, which tends to be weedy and form dense populations. The vast majority of them, you'll find only a handful of plants in the population. And many of them are very, very habitat specific. And they're incredibly beautiful plants, and I hope that they will catch on even more for horticulture.
Yeah. But I was actually surprised. I didn't know that vinca and amsonia were even related. So that was, even again with my relatively limited ability to grasp everything in one of the reports, I learned a lot from reading that report.
Well, that's wonderful. You know what I mean? I don't agree with you that it's your limited ability. I think it's just that there is so much to learn. We have so much to learn about our native flora, and every person who has the will to do so with the manual can really start at any given point. They can jump in on any family.
Well, and that there were two other reports that caught my eye. One was the geraniums, the Geraniaceae. Is that how I would? Yeah. And so, and you know, I think a lot of people who are gardeners think, oh, perennial geraniums, those are Geranium mycorrhizum or whatever. They're geraniums that are not from the United States and are not naturalized or whatever. Probably here, but we have a number of both non-native and native species that are in your report, for instance. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember this treatment of the Geraniaceae. We had a number of species that were not in Gleason and Cronquist, like we'd been saying, that are non-natives. And then some others that we've learned more about, some natives that about which we've learned more since the publication of the 91 Gleason and Cronquist. So you're right. It's another good example.
Where I garden, when I first came to the place, there were two, and they were not in the same, anywhere near the same spot, and I've never, there's sort of two buildings at my house and separated by a little bit of a distance. And in one area grows Geranium maculatum, I think would be is that correct?
Wild geranium.
And then in another area, far away from it, Geranium robertianum.
Of course.
And they don't seem to want to be in the same spot, but they're both geraniums. And I guess now, having read the report that you've done on the geraniums, I learned that maybe there's some dispute about whether robertianum is actually native back all the way in time.
Right.
So,
for the longest time, we considered it an introduction from Europe. And then more recent evidence has been accumulating that maybe it had been here all along. Either way, if it is an introduction, it was very, very early. But even its name reveals what a link it has had with our human civilization. It's named for St. Robert.
Yeah.
Most of our plants we give descriptive names to, whether it be some aspect of their appearance or their geography. But in this case, Geranium robertianum. And I had to chuckle because it's Herb Robert.
I know, Herb Robert. I know. But you weren't around when it was named.
Definitely not. Thank goodness for that.
Yeah. So I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about orchids, because, again, you know, for a lot of gardeners, they think, oh, orchids, houseplant, whatever. They don't know. And maybe they know cypripediums or something. Maybe they've heard of or seen at a native plant garden one or two examples of native orchids. But really, they don't know about it. And there were a lot of orchids in this report.
Oh, very much so. North America, and especially the Northeast, the region covered by the new manual, has a very rich orchid flora and many genera. And I'm especially excited by this treatment that we just published this year, because we have two lead authors. The new manual is a collaborative effort, and we collaborate because we benefit from the expertise of people throughout the world. And so we've brought two of the world's experts on the orchid family: Matthew Pace, who is here at New York Botanical Garden, and John Freudenstein of Ohio State University. So they teamed up, and another exciting thing about this treatment is, in the last few years, each one of them has been describing new species of orchids. And each one of them has one of the species that they described in this treatment.
Oh. It
occurs in the Northeast.
Oh, that's nice, huh?
Yeah, it is. It is very nice. So John Freudenstein had a coral root, Corallariza bentleyi, and Matthew Pace had a lady's tresses, Spiranthes archicepala. So another thing about this treatment is, because of the great interest in orchids, so much has been done on studying the Orchidaceae, the orchid family, that we've made all these great advances, and this is a treatment that especially reflects that increase in botanical knowledge. So whether it be in the recent discoveries in the field, or whether it be in the new names we have them, whether it be in the new classifications for them, all of those aspects are reflected. And then there's a lot of conservation concern, especially as we see many of our native orchids decline. And then another thing I like about this treatment is the vast majority, actually all but one, of the species in this treatment are native to the area.
That was what I was overwhelmed by. I didn't know there were so many.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
I really recommend this treatment to everyone and all of your listeners.
It was an eye-opener for me, definitely. So in the last 2-3 minutes that we have, I wanted to ask you about something not related to the manual or the work, the treatments. I know you were a professor for many years, I believe. I believe you taught. Yeah. And so did you ever teach like taxonomy 101 or system plant systematics 101? Beginner. Okay. So I'm a gardener. What's a good place for gardeners, listeners, readers to start? I mean, are there books or whatever? And I see that New York Botanical Garden Adult Education Division is going to offer in the winter its botanical Latin course again. But are there, books, websites? Where do we start? Any recommendations or tips?
Well, I love your question, and being a professor, I love to turn people on to botany, especially plant systematics. So if your listeners have a botanical garden nearby that has a public education outreach, almost certainly there will be courses in plant identification, plant systematics, plant diversity. I would recommend those. If not a garden, then a botanical society or a wildflower society. There are many, many such societies, fortunately, and many of them do have courses. There are also some wonderful books out there, and some of them can be advanced, and some are beginner level, so jump in whatever level is appropriate. But one that I would recommend as especially excellent is called Plant Systematics, a Phylogenetic Approach, and it's by Walter Judd and his colleagues. That's J-U-D-D.
Mm.
And then there are a lot of websites on plant identification, basic principles of classification, and I would enter words like taxonomy, systematics, phylogeny, and that's P-H-Y-L-O-G-E-N-Y.
Phylogeny.
So I think we have an abundance of resources. Certainly the human element, botanists that can teach these courses, make it a lot easier for people. So I really do think one of the best ways is teaming up, finding a hopefully local outlet like New York Botanical Garden, which has a very robust offering of courses in all these subjects.
And I'll give some links to the upcoming courses there, and I'll find some others to augment the transcript. But I'm so glad to speak to you today, Rob Nazzi from New York Botanical Garden, about this work. Thank you so much for making the time.
Well, you're welcome, Margaret, and thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden, and I'm at awaytogarden on Instagram, too. Happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.